I'm Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine. You're listening to CKUT. Keep listening.
Spring Into Action, Outrage, is happening March 11th through 24th. Spring Into Action is an annual event series that is organized and funded by QPIRG McGill and SSMU. Every spring, QPIRG organizes a week of free workshops, discussions, film screenings, and social events, engaging local and global issues. We have an exciting lineup of events, including a screen printing workshop, community dinner and zine making night, Prison Abolition 101, and other practical and capacity building workshops for organizing in the midst of injustice and anger. Check out the schedule of events at QPIRGMcGill.org or on our Instagram at QPIRGMcGill.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
Famine is imminent in northern Gaza. That's according to a UN-backed report published Monday. The latest findings say virtually everyone in Gaza is struggling to get enough food and that nearly a third of the population of 2.3 million people are experiencing the highest levels of catastrophic hunger. At least 27 people, mostly children, have died from malnutrition and dehydration in the north. According to the new report, the death rate's expected to accelerate and reach famine levels soon. The World Health Organization said in a statement, quote, "The IPC report confirms that we, our UN partners and NGOs, have been witnessing and reporting for months. When our missions reach hospitals, we meet exhausted and hungry health workers who ask us for food and water. We see patients trying to recover from life-saving surgeries and losses of limbs, or sick with cancer or diabetes, mothers who've just given birth or newborn babies all suffering from hunger and the diseases that stalk it," end quote. This comes as the Israeli military launched another major raid on El Shifa Hospital in Gaza City Monday, with Israeli forces backed by tanks and artillery surrounding the complex and troops storming into a number of buildings. The health ministry said about 30,000 people had been sheltering at the hospital, which is the largest hospital in Gaza, and that everyone who tries to move is targeted by sniper bullets and quadcopters, they said. Among those killed in the raid was Faik Abkhouh, a senior officer in the Gaza police who was in charge of coordinating aid distribution in the north. Meanwhile, President Biden warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a telephone call Monday that an invasion of Rafah would be a mistake and called on Netanyahu to send a team of officials to Washington to discuss an alternative approach to targeting Hamas and Rafah without a major ground invasion. Israel's continued to bomb Rafah almost daily, prompting the Palestinian Foreign Ministry to say Israel's already begun its large-scale attack on the area. The death toll in Gaza is close to 32,000, over a third of them children, while nearly 74,000 people have been injured. For more, we're joined by Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, Palestinian physician, activist, politician. He serves as general secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative. He's joining us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Dr. Barghouti, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's talk about this issue of famine. Doctors describing the wasting that you see, for example, at the temples of people who are dying of starvation, particularly children. Can you talk about what this means and when these officials in the UN and other bodies talk about this man-made disaster?
Well, the reality is that the whole of Gaza population, 2.3 million people, are suffering from malnutrition already. That includes children, men, women, pregnant women, breastfeeding women, everybody. And that is because of the Israeli-imposed siege on Gaza, which is combined with continuous bombardment that is taking away the lives of people. But it is also combined with the fact that Israel has destroyed more than 70% of people's homes. They don't have normal place to be in. They don't have normal clothes. They don't have clean water to drink. And they don't have food supplies. And this is all happening in front of the world. We're talking about famine. We're talking about hunger. And we are talking about actually 700,000 people starving now in the north of Gaza. That includes also Gaza City, of whom 350,000 are children. And that's why I think almost 30 children have died because of starvation already. This is all happening because of the Israeli siege, because nobody in the world, not the United States, not Europe, not the international community as a whole, is capable of forcing Israel to stop this terrible crime of collective punishment against a whole population. And Israel will not change its policy and its approach without sanctions. The world should impose sanctions on Israel to force it to open the roads of supplies of humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza and to accept a ceasefire. Because even if supplies are there and the bombardment continues, people will survive to die. That is the reality of the situation. Today, 5% of the total population of Gaza have been killed or injured. We're talking about almost 120,000 people. If that had happened in the United States of America, you would be talking about almost 12 million people killed or injured in 5 months of this terrible war. So that is the reality of the situation. But add to that, malnutrition causes low immunity. Lack of water causes diseases. There is an outbreak of certain diseases like infectious hepatitis, which has already affected 10,000 people. We have 32 medical teams from our organization, Palestinian Medical Relief Society, working in Gaza, and they report horrible reports. About 1 million people at this very moment in Gaza are sick with respiratory diseases, with gastrointestinal infections, with diarrhea, with hepatitis. And our biggest worry is the outbreak of certain infections among children, because these children in Gaza have not had vaccination for more than 165 days.
Can you talk about, I think it's the fourth raid now on El Shifa, and they say tens of thousands of people that are taking refuge there. The Israeli military and spokespeople saying they're very careful. They have highly trained forces, that they separate the civilians from the militants. And them talking about a high-level Hamas official, Faik Mabou, killing him along with other fighters. Mabou, apparently, top food the person in charge of food distribution in the north.
First of all, the Israeli army is lying when they say that they differentiate between civilians and non-civilians. How can this explain the fact that more than 80% of the people who were killed are civilians, women and children mainly? How can they explain that 70% of everybody killed are children and women? They lie, and they lie around the clock. And each time they are caught with a crime that is obvious, like shooting the people who are starving in the north, trying to get some food from humanitarian aid, and they shot them. We're talking about 400 people shot while they were trying to get some flour. These people are totally civilians. They're not armed. They're not threat to anybody, but they killed them, in addition to injuring more than 3,000 other people. So they keep lying, and I don't believe their lies. Now, Mr. Mabhouh, who was killed, is a policeman. He's not a fighter. He's not from Qassam Brigade. He's not he's not carrying arms to fight. He was simply organizing some supplies to get to the north. And for the first time, 2 days ago, 13 trucks with some flour got to the north of Gaza. Clearly, and this was well organized, people received their portions. There were no gangs to steal this supply. And obviously, this is something that Israelis didn't like. They didn't like that people were organized and getting some supplies after so many days of hunger. And that's why they killed Mr. Mabhouh. They want chaos in Gaza. And their goal from attacking Shifa Hospital is actually to push people from Shifa Hospital and from Gaza City to the south again, because the ultimate goal of Israel is ethnic cleansing. And the reality is that the whole operation, military operation to attack Rafah is already ready to be implemented, and maybe parts of it has already started to be implemented, as you mentioned. And there, why are they attacking Rafah with 1.4 million people there in an area that is very small? It does not exceed 25 square miles. They will cause a terrible massacre, but their real goal is to push people through the borders to Egypt, because Netanyahu did not change his original plan of ethnic cleansing. And the United States government, Mr. Biden and his administration, instead of saying to Netanyahu, you cannot have an operation in Rafah, and you have to stop this fight, and you have to accept ceasefire, instead of that, they are deciding to become part of his war cabinet, discussing the plans of how to attack Rafah, rather than saying that this attack should not take place.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan briefed reporters on this last call between Biden and Netanyahu. He laid out the concerns Biden expressed about that possible ground invasion of Rafah.
First, more than a million people have taken refuge in Rafah. They went from Gaza City to Khan Yunis and then to Rafah. And they have nowhere else to go. Gaza's other major cities have largely been destroyed. And Israel has not presented us or the world with a plan for how or where they would safely move those civilians, let alone feed and house them and ensure access to basic things like sanitation. But a major ground operation there would be a mistake. It would lead to more innocent civilian deaths, worsen the already dire humanitarian crisis, deepen the anarchy in Gaza, and further isolate Israel internationally.
So if you can talk about what this team from the Israeli government is that's going to Washington, D.C. to come up with a so-called alternative plan, although Israel keeps insisting they don't kill Palestinian civilians, they have very targeted troops that know exactly the difference between them, and what it means to say if they attack Rafah, which, of course, every day they are doing, but a full-scale ground invasion, they will establish humanitarian humanitarian islands for people to go to?
That's not true, because there is no safe place anymore in Gaza. And if there are places which will not be bombarded, as they claim, they are places without any infrastructure, without water, without electricity, without food, without medical services, without medicines, without anything. Where would people go? To talk about the possibility of such an attack that it would cause more harm is not enough. It will cause a huge massacre, the largest massacre in human history, probably, at least in the modern history. We will be talking about tens of thousands of people who will be slaughtered. That is the reality. And they have no place to escape to. Israel kept saying to people, move from this place to that place, it will be safe, and then they would bombard the safe space. So the United States should not say, I repeat, should not say there isn't a good plan. They should say that the whole attack should not happen and that this war must stop. And when the Israelis say they differentiate, they are lying. Are the 14,000 Palestinian children who were killed military activists or militants? These are children, for God's sake. And they are not 19 or 18 years old. These are 10 years old, 2 years old, 1 year old, even months old. That is the reality of what's happening in Gaza. It's a massacre. It's a huge genocide that Israel is engaging in. And the United States of America does not have the guts to go to the United Nations Security Council resolution and allow the passage of a resolution demanding immediate ceasefire. That's what we need, immediate ceasefire, no attack on Rafah, and supplies immediately to the civilian population of Gaza, which is starving.
And can you tell
other thing?
Can you talk
any other thing? Is just talk, yeah. Please.
About the negotiations that are going on in Qatar right now. Talk about what Hamas has put forward.
Hamas tried, as the reports show that Hamas tried to be flexible. They made some concessions to make it possible to reach an agreement because they are really worried about the humanitarian situation of the people and the so many people who have been killed. But unfortunately, Netanyahu restricted the team that went to Qatar. He restricted their authority and authorization. And in my frank opinion, I think Netanyahu he made all these restrictions with his team to prevent reaching an agreement and then use that failure to justify an attack on Rafah. I do not think, because Netanyahu knows if he goes into a deal with Hamas about release of some prisoners and exchange of prisoners, his coalition partners, the fascists, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, will bring his government down. So all he thinks about is how to save himself, how to save his position. He doesn't care about Israeli prisoners. He knows very well that if he attacks Rafah, so many Israeli prisoners will be killed. He knows that, but he doesn't care about them. And he's stuck with these fascists in his government, and he's driving his whole government into the direction, and actually the Israeli society at large is driving them into the direction of fascism, because what's happening in Palestine cannot be made except by people who have no respect whatsoever, not only to international law, but to human lives in general.
You're in the occupied West Bank, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. You're in Ramallah. Can you talk about the arrests of journalists? You have Ismail Al-Ghul. He's with Al Jazeera Arabic, stripped naked there for hours, detained, interrogated with others when they raided Al-Shifa Hospital. Al Jazeera reported that satellite trucks were attacked outside. That's TV satellite trucks to restrict further images. You have in the occupied West Bank, Rula Hassanein, who is a Palestinian journalist. It's unclear if she was taken from her home in Ramallah or was at Bethlehem at like 2 in the morning, has a 9-month-old baby, is breastfeeding. This just happened. The attack on journalists, and what do you think is the message Israel is sending?
The message is that they are reoccupying all of the West Bank and all of Gaza, subjecting all Palestinian people without exception to terrible oppression. And as you know, Amy, since the beginning of this war, Israel did not allow any foreign journalist to enter Gaza, except for one from CNN who was allowed there only for 3 hours. They didn't allow any foreign journalist in, and then they started executing the local journalists. Up to now, 146 Palestinian journalists in Gaza were killed by Israeli snipers or Israeli bombardment, including 2 from Al Jazeera network. And now they've arrested the third one, Al-Ghul, and practically tortured him before releasing him. And you remember the story of the family of Dahdouh, who lost his wife, his children, and because he was reporting for Al Jazeera. And in my opinion, the attacks on journalists are also taking place in the West Bank. More than 30 journalists were arrested so far, and it goes on. And in the West Bank, by the way, Israel has arrested more than 7,500 new people. The total number of people in Israeli jails in the West Bank has risen from 5,300 to almost 9,000. And one thing that the world doesn't talk about is the terrible torture that the people in Israeli prisons are subjected to. They are fighting them, torturing them with hunger. They brought down the rations for their food rations by 70%. They beat them regularly. Most recently, they attacked even one of the political prisoners, Marwan Barghouti, and many of his colleagues as well, beating them badly. And it goes on. We have lost already 13 people in Israeli jails because of torture and because of beating and because of starvation. The situation in Israeli prisons is horrifying. And in Gaza, we don't know exactly the number of people who were imprisoned or kidnapped. We're talking about thousands of people, maybe 3,000, maybe 4,000. But the people who were released told us horrible stories about how they were tortured in an Israeli concentration camp in the Negev with electrical shocks, with drowning them in the water, with terrible beating. The director of Shifa Hospital is still imprisoned. They broke both of his hands, as was reported, and they tried to force him to admit things that he never did. That is the reality and the situation on the ground. It's horrifying.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, I want to thank you for being with us. Palestinian physician, activist, politician, serves as General Secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative, speaking to us from his office in the occupied West Bank in Ramallah.
This is the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm Dave Reed. In mid-December 2023, 2.5 months into Israel's war on Gaza, a UN-affiliated committee of famine experts reported that over 500,000 Gazans faced catastrophic hunger. All 2.3 million were in crisis, and the situation was deteriorating rapidly. On the eve of the Famine Review Committee's follow-up assessment, forced starvation in Gaza is getting worse, fast. In a March 5th statement, 7 UN experts declared that Israel has been intentionally starving Gaza and that widespread famine in the besieged, brutalized enclave is imminent. According to Gaza health officials and a senior doctor cited on March 8th by the Associated Press, at least 20 people have died from dehydration and malnutrition at North Gaza's Kamal Adwan and Al-Shifa hospitals, and 16 premature babies have succumbed to malnutrition-related disorders at Rafah's Emirati hospital. On March 10, Al Jazeera reported 25 known starvation deaths in northern Gaza. David Kattenberg spoke with the first author of the statement, Michael Fakhri, special UN rapporteur on the right to food.
Hello, Michael Fakhri. Can you introduce yourself? Tell me who you are, a bit about your background.
Yeah, my name is Michael Fakhri. I'm the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food. I'm an independent expert given authority by the Human Rights Council. It's a volunteer position. And the shortest way to understand the job is I'm the eyes, ears, and good conscience for the UN system on all matters regarding hunger, malnutrition, and famine from a human rights perspective. I teach at the law school at the University of Oregon. I used to be a lawyer in Toronto, and I'm originally from Lebanon.
And are you Canadian?
I am. I'm both from Lebanon and from Canada.
And your academic background, you have an academic background in food and nutrition and the humanitarian aspects of food provision and hunger and all that?
My background is in international law with a focus on food and agriculture. So I started a lot of my research early on was on trade and development, which quickly turned into a focus on food sovereignty and the right to food. But since one of the main causes of hunger is conflict today, I'm also focusing more and more on conflict, on starvation, on international humanitarian law, international criminal law. I'm always focusing on food and agriculture and letting that sort of lead where I go in my research, in my professional life, and in my personal life. I mean, food is pleasure. Food is how we express our love for each other. It's how we hang out. It's how we connect with our past. It's how we, admittedly, I stress eat. So there's that aspect too. So it's sometimes trite to say, but food is everything. And it's infinite in terms of how one can understand the world and enjoy life.
The things that people eat, it's more than just nutrition. It's more than just enjoying a meal and eating your favorite foods. The things we eat, less so in Western societies, but the things we eat kind of are a reflection of our cultural roots. They mean something to us culturally. They certainly do to the Palestinian people. You think about all the things that Palestinians enjoy eating. It's part of their culture, isn't it?
Exactly. It's existential. So what you eat is pleasure on a personal, individual basis, but it's cultural in the sense of it connects you to the land. It connects you to the oceans and seas and rivers. It connects you to your ancestors. And not to say that how we eat is frozen in time, but to your point about olives, when Israeli settlers and Israeli forces are uprooting olive trees or denying Palestinian farmers in the West Bank from harvesting their olives, the olive tree is central to what it means to be Palestinian because it's that long-standing connection to the land. Olive trees can live for over hundreds of years. And it's not just the Palestinian people. All people, that is one key way people define themselves as a collective, as a people, as a culture, one way is almost always through food. Because again, food connects you to, you know, I don't like using the concept nature. Nature, I feel, is abstract, but it connects you to the land, to living beings around you. It's that relationship. Eating is something that really reflects a relationship.
And, you know, we're moving along a tangent here. There's lots of stuff I want to talk about. Like, I think about Palestinians in the West Bank going and harvesting, picking wild herbs, thyme, and getting attacked by settlers or getting shot by soldiers in the course of foraging for little plants and things that they enjoy eating, but which are part of their culture.
Yeah, exactly. So foraging za'atar or thyme, I mean, I'm from Lebanon, so it's the same for us as well. So that also tells you in terms of connectivity and relationships is Palestine, they're harvesting and foraging for za'atar in Lebanon, in Syria. And what was happening in Israel is Israel passed a law under the umbrella of sort of conservation of nature, denying anyone the ability to harvest wild za'atar. But what that was in effect was targeting Palestinians' ability to forage. So foraging is about eating, of course, but again, it's yet another way of connecting to the land. And so if you think of Palestinian people of indigenous to the land, and you think of, for example, indigenous people in North America, the similarities of foraging practices and that those foraging practices, it's knowledge, is knowing where to go, knowing how much to forage so that you don't over-harvest, knowing when to forage. This is real knowledge that's passed on through generation.
And knowing where your parents and your grandparents picked these wild plants and having accompanied them when you were a child doing it and learning where to go and what to pick.
Exactly. And those memories carry so much power. Those memories really become a defining aspect. So that's what I mean by the pleasure of food is not just the eating. The pleasure of food is in those memories that we make and the recipes we share. They really become so defining in that way.
In your March 5th news release as a special rapporteur, along with a host of other special rapporteurs following the February 29th flour massacre in Gaza, you write, Israel has been intentionally starving the Palestinian people. What evidence do you have that Israeli authorities, the military, are actually intentionally starving?
They said it themselves. On October 8th, the Minister of Defense of Israel announced a total siege against Gaza. Sorry, that was October 9th. On October 8th, Israel cut off all water from all of Gaza for a couple weeks. Then they returned water just to southern Gaza, did not let the water flow back into northern Gaza. And the Minister of Infrastructure and Energy said it, that the purpose of cutting off water to everywhere at first and only returning water to the south was to push everyone from the north to the south. That's just two examples. Time and time and time again, they keep saying it, that they're going to deny the flow of food, fuel, and medicine into Gaza. And then they do it. And now we're seeing the effects. And the effects now are we're starting to see children dying from malnutrition and dehydration, which indicates that there's probably a famine or that famine's around the corner. It's just sort of unfolding at a speed we've never seen before. We've never seen children pushed into malnutrition so quickly. This is all preventable. And I'll add one more fact, you know, in the current negotiations between Israel and Hamas, one of the negotiating points that Israel has put forward as something to offer to get concessions from Hamas is the provision and allowing for humanitarian aid to enter into Gaza. And that means that Israel's using humanitarian aid as a bargaining chip, to the point that that's actually what President Biden said today, that Israel should not use humanitarian aid as a bargaining chip. Sort of the president of the U.S. has reaffirmed what we put in our press release. Moreover, Israel is destroying the food system in Gaza. So it's not just denying humanitarian aid. It's not just shooting at civilians trying to get humanitarian aid. It's not just bombarding convoys of humanitarian trucks, even though those humanitarian trucks are coordinating with them. They're destroying the food system, meaning they've destroyed over 80% of the fishing fleets and fishing nets of small-scale fishers in Gaza. They're destroying agricultural land, fields, greenhouses, orchards. They're using white phosphorus, which poisons the land, so it makes it almost impossible to farm on that land in the near future.
Where are they using white phosphorus? Is this eastern Gaza in the agricultural margin?
Yes, they're using white phosphorus in eastern Gaza, and they're using white phosphorus in southern Lebanon.
I just want to pursue this because, you know, this idea that Israel is systematically denying food and humanitarian supplies to the Palestinians. I'm looking at a media flash from this entity in Canada that claims to advocate for honest reporting. They're really an agent of the Israeli government. What they say, it might as well be an IDF release. Here this entity says, since the beginning of the Hamas-instigated war in October, more than 14,000 trucks filled with humanitarian aid have entered Gaza, in addition to a growing number of airdrops. The amount of aid that is entering Gaza is also growing. On March 3rd, 277 trucks with humanitarian aid entered Gaza, the largest shipment in a single day. Israeli officials have repeatedly said there is no limit the amount of aid that can enter Gaza. So Israeli military and government sources and their media proxies are saying that Israel is moving heaven and earth to get aid and food into Gaza, but it's the aid distribution networks that are just really incompetent. Everybody is to blame for the situation except for Israel. And there, you know, thousands of trucks have been moving in. How do you comment on that?
So, you know, let's put this into context. Let's start even before the war. Before the war, Israel was imposing a blockade on Gaza for, it's about 17 years now. And the result of that blockade is they were denying the flow of a lot of food. And the result was that 50% of people in Gaza were food insecure, and 80% of people in Gaza depended on humanitarian aid. So for people to sort of hit the bare minimum of receiving enough food, and we're not even talking good quality and nutritious food, just like a bare minimum to get by, 500 trucks a day had to go into Gaza. This is before the war. Now the average, and this average comes from UN humanitarian organizations and other humanitarian organizations, the average ranges between 85 to 100 a day, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. That's not enough by any means. We know from humanitarian organizations that they're saying they're being held up at the border, that the process of entering, there's two crossing points. One is with Israel, Karim Shalom, and the other is Rafah with Egypt. The most goes through the Karim Shalom entry point through Israel. And we know from humanitarian organizations in the United Nations that the process is confusing, it's complicated, it's arbitrary. And they've indicated basically that they're being restricted. And all the UN agencies and all relief organizations and countries are saying, we are ready to provide as much aid as necessary to get in, and we're not being allowed in. What little aid is getting in, most of it is not going to the north. The north has been really blocked out from any aid in that effort, again, to sort of push everyone from the north to the south, which I might add is a war crime to do that to civilians. What aid does get through then, those convoys will coordinate with Israeli forces. And nevertheless, there's repeated reports from the UN that they are then bombarded. And then let's say the convoy gets through the border, it's not bombarded. And then there's over 14 reported incidents of Israel shooting at civilians while they're seeking aid. The most recent flower massacre that you referred to from the press release was not the only one. That's one of a series. That one was just the worst one, in which Israeli soldiers shot at civilians, leading to the death of approximately 114 people and the injury of around 750. Sky News reported yesterday that the Israeli humanitarian agency, COGAT, I believe is the acronym, said that they're ready to provide humanitarian aid to people in Gaza. They haven't received the political green light yet from the appropriate ministries. And on top of that, when you see, as we've seen recently, the use of airdropping as a form of humanitarian relief, that's a measure of last resort. That's a desperate measure. It's incredibly expensive. It's incredibly inefficient. Humanitarian agencies all agree that it's very ineffective. That indicates that they're unable to get through otherwise. And now President Biden has announced he's going to build an ad hoc pier. It's sort of they're going to use the military to build a pier to bring in some aid through the sea. That's also not very effective. And we're seeing famine is imminent. I mean, we're seeing the effects as well, not even talking about how, whether or not aid's getting through. We're seeing the effects. You add that all up, and that tells us that no, humanitarian aid is not entering sufficiently by any means. You know, what's interesting about the airdrops and this sort of maritime entry point, usually countries do that when they're trying to get humanitarian relief into enemy territory. I believe this is the first time the United States has done airdrops and has done this sort of maritime entry in a situation where it's in an ally's territory.
And where it's actually providing all the weapons and the bombs and the missiles.
Yeah, so it's American bombs and American aid dropping at the same time. The degree of vile absurdity, I mean, that's the only, I think, way I can describe it in that regard.
Let's talk about the actual situation on the ground. But can you preface that by explaining what's the difference between hunger and widespread hunger and famine?
Yeah, I mean, there's these technical terms one can measure: hunger, acute hunger, famine. When we start talking about famine or near famine, what we're talking about is people are starting to die from lack of sufficient food and nutrients. That's what's happening. People are dying or starting to die. That's where we're at in Gaza.
And how many people, can you put some numbers to this? The whole population is food insecure. What are the metrics for hunger and what are the metrics for famine? How many people have actually died? We've heard about like 15 children, newborns, infants who've died of malnutrition. I've seen images on Al Jazeera of kids that are starting to look like little Biafrans.
So everyone's hungry. 2.3 million people were pushed into hunger at a speed we've never seen before. We've never seen a civilian population made to go hungry so completely and so quickly. Never in modern history. We've never seen children pushed into malnutrition so quickly. Never. This is in consultation, based on my own experience, but in consultation with starvation experts around the world and with UN humanitarian workers and leaders. This is the consensus amongst everyone who studies and works in this area. So famine is very difficult in this instance because it's a war zone. So in terms of famine, in terms of understanding how it's measured in technical terms, there's three conditions that need to be met. First, at least 20% of the population is affected. In Gaza, we've seen that. The second condition, which is where we're at now, is that one out of three children are being acutely malnourished. This is also known as wasting. We're seeing that. The third condition is the hardest to measure. And this is that two people, for every 10,000 inhabitants, two people are dying every day because of starvation or malnutrition and disease, not because of bombing or bullets or that sort of thing. In talking with the people who measure famine, the consensus is that because they're in the middle of a war right now there, and it's hard to get in, people are being denied entry into Gaza, reporters are being denied, humanitarian workers are being denied entry. It's hard to determine the degree of how many people are actually dying from malnutrition and disease and hunger versus bombs and bullets. Nevertheless, the fact that we're seeing now 15, I think, children, maybe the number today might even be up to 20, dying from malnutrition and dehydration, what that tells all of us, that tells us is that there probably already is a famine. And the speed, this is the part that's unique, the speed in which we're watching deterioration, the speed of the spread of hunger, the speed of death, the rate of death is really unprecedented. So it almost doesn't matter whether it meets the formal criteria of famine or not. What we know is that the conditions are almost unimaginable.
And here you say in your press release of March 5th, as the risk of famine continues to rise, all children under five, there are 335,000 children under five, are at a high risk of severe malnutrition.
Exactly. And that's a conservative estimate at a risk of malnutrition, right? They're being very tempered in the statistics. So what everyone agrees is what we can measure is actually an underestimate of the reality. Once we can have people enter into Gaza, more humanitarian workers and reporters, I have no doubt, and this is again in consultation with experts all over the world, we all have no doubt that the horror, the numbers, the degree of hunger, the degree of death from malnutrition will be higher than we're able to measure right now.
So at this moment, where are these metrics? Where is this primary data coming from? Where do you get your primary data in Gaza if so many health workers, NGOs are not allowed to go in? Where do you get your primary data?
From UN agencies, all the different UN agencies, UNICEF, what's called OCHA, the Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Aid, UNRWA, which is the UN Relief and Work Agency, FAO, the Food and Agricultural Organization. And then on hunger and famine, that metric and that measurement is done through what's called IPC. IPC is the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification. And that is a group of experts that are organized through the UN Food and Agricultural Organization. The World Food Program is another source.
And these folks, they have people on the ground in Gaza.
Some do, and they all share what they can. So, for example, UNRWA, the UN Relief and Work Agency, they are there. OCHA, the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Aid, are in Gaza. And that's where I start. I always start with OCHA and UNRWA. And then UNICEF is engaged. And then there's different ways one can do it through satellite imagery. And methodologically, it seems quite sound. And everyone is aware of the limitations. So that's why everyone's saying, we're probably underestimating. They would rather err on a conservative approach due to the limitations for those that might not have direct access, that might be using other methods, or the difficulty in measuring in the midst of an ongoing and escalating war. So again, these are numbers that I think are on the lower side than actual reality.
And there are reports of people eating animal feed and weeds, plants they pick from the ground.
They're feeding their children that. That's the part where it's brutal. They're foregoing meals. Grown up adults who have to choose who gets to eat in the family will prioritize the children, which everyone would do. And then all they have to offer their children is animal feed, which then actually leads to a lot of health issues. It does lead to malnutrition. It can lead to death if you're feeding them with whatever you have. There's no water. There's very little clean water in Gaza. People are having to drink dirty water. Knowing it's dirty water, they really have no choice. The part for me, it's almost hard to understand or process, is this point we're at where children are dying from malnutrition and dehydration, and looking at those images and talking to colleagues who have talked to families in those situations. Imagine being unable to feed your child and your child looking at you and there's nothing you can do. Then they die.
And you write here, at least 90% of children under 5 are affected by one or more infectious diseases, and 70% have diarrhea. What's the intersection between hunger, starvation, and infectious disease? And what can you tell me about the infectious disease situation in Gaza today?
When you don't get adequate food, and you're not getting sufficient nutrients, and you're low on energy, your immune system gets weaker. When your immune system gets weaker, you're going to be more vulnerable to infectious diseases. That's one. But two, the conditions that have led to hunger are often the same conditions that lead to higher rates of disease. The destruction of civil infrastructure, the lack of water, the lack of hospitals. Very few hospitals are left in Gaza. People living in close proximity, not living in their homes. They're living outside. They're living in tents, being forced to migrate. You combine all of that together, and that leads to exposure and vulnerability to infectious diseases.
Now, you know, we're talking about hunger, starvation, famine, wasting, infectious disease, but there are going to be long-term generational impacts of this. Tens of thousands of children going hungry. What impact is this going to have on their long-term development prospects?
Yeah, this is what doctors would call stunting. There's a high risk of stunting for almost every child in Gaza. What that means is that when children between the ages of 0 and 5 don't receive adequate nutrients, that can lead to permanent physical and cognitive impairment in the future. So that would mean is that these kids in the future are going to require a significant amount of support to make sure that they can live a life with dignity. But then think of the trauma. 2.3 million people now have experienced profound trauma in ways I can't even pretend to know what that is. The number of children that have lost their entire family that are left alone, the psychological scars of people that managed to survive are at a scale and to a degree. I mean, it's as if Israel is trying to dam all the children in Gaza.
Little snakes, Ayelet Shaked called them.
Yeah, children of the night, snakes. I mean, the dehumanizing language was from the first day. You know, I've been very focused in our conversation on what's happening on the ground. But if we're going to get into the dehumanizing language and the racism and the callousness, that was from the beginning. This is why we raised the alarm of genocide within weeks of this particular war, was the blatant dehumanization expressed by Israeli politicians and decision makers against the Palestinian people. So when you don't imagine a people as human or as civilians, then you employ all of these policies and techniques that we're witnessing in Gaza.
The Flower Massacre of March 5th, 112 or so people reported killed I understand that multiple Gaza health authorities report a very large percentage of these people coming in with gunshot wounds. But the Israelis, of course, deny it. The Israelis say, no, 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 they got run over by trucks or, you know, killed in the stampede. And IDF forces, they're the most moral soldiers in the world. They're ordered not to attack people without cause. And at one point, checkpoint was rushed and soldiers felt threatened. So they shot people aiming for their legs. But they just strenuously, categorically deny that they were shooting at people. There have also been reports of people rushing to get food and getting gunned down by drones. That's another story. But how do you address Israeli denials that they're actually intentionally targeting starved Gazans going for food?
Yeah, I think to understand what's going on, context matters. And sort of to put this one particular incident in a broader context in space and time. So to step back, Gaza City, where the Flower Massacre happened, is in northern Gaza. So from the 8th of October to the 15th of October, Israel completely shut off three water pipelines that go into Gaza. They shut off basically 75% of all of Gaza's water supply. Then in mid to end of October, water is restored in a limited way to central and southern Gaza, but it was never restored to northern Gaza. And this is when the Israeli Minister for Energy and Infrastructure said that we're not restoring water to northern Gaza because, quote, we want to push the civilian population to the southern strip. That's in the beginning of the war, to give you a sense of how northern Gaza is really cut off, where Gaza City is. And to cut now to January 22nd, WHO, the World Health Organization, was forced to stop delivering medical supplies. They just couldn't get in. They were unable to get in into the north. This is January. January 23rd, the next day, UNRWA, the main humanitarian agency in Gaza, they were forced to stop delivery of aid to the north. Both they're being denied and the shelling, so UNRWA was denied. They're unable to get to the north. All that's left is the World Food Program. By February 20th now, World Food Program can't get into northern Gaza as well. So you see how it's just squeezing and strangling, Israel's squeezing and strangling northern Gaza, as they said they were going to do. They announce it, and then they actually implement it, and they're doing it. So by February 20th, no one can get into northern Gaza. So that was a week from the 20th to the 28th. February 28th, aid resumes into northern Gaza. February 29th is the Flower Massacre. So that's first the context of how desperate and brutalized people were in northern Gaza. Combined with before the Flower Massacre happened, we knew of at least, this is through UN reports, at least 14 instances of Israeli soldiers shooting at civilians while they're trying to get aid. We know this is already happening. And then the Flower Massacre happens. We do know that soldiers shot at civilians while getting aid. Now, there are reports through the UN confirming a large number of people that died from bullet wounds. But let's just take that fact aside. Let's pretend we don't know how many people died from bullet wounds. Israeli soldiers are not allowed to shoot at civilians while they're getting humanitarian aid. Full stop. That's it. The soldiers felt scared, whatever. The conditions were created by Israel up until that point. If you shoot at civilians who are desperate, it's going to lead to chaos. So Israeli forces shot at civilians getting humanitarian aid, which is a war crime, creating the conditions of fear and panic. I will add, but we do know how many people were killed by bullet wounds. The UN has verified a lot of this, so that's what happened.
I want to ask you what the international community should do, but I mean, really, it comes down to what the United States should do. And Biden yesterday in his State of the Union address announced with huge fanfare that they were going to build this maritime port, temporary port. There wouldn't be any boots on the ground in Gaza, but they would deliver food from Cyprus, and there'd be massive influx within a couple of weeks in this way. What do you think the United States should do? And if other powers aside from the United States were to suddenly decide we're going to do this ourselves, I don't know if they could or couldn't, but what should the international community do focusing on the United States?
First and foremost, the United States needs to stop sending money and weapons to Israel. Second, what the international community could do is impose an economic embargo against Israel. large number of countries, including Arab countries, trade with Israel. And if we look back to apartheid era South Africa, that was a significant tool which pressured the apartheid regime in South Africa. That's real action. That's what will pressure Israel towards a permanent ceasefire and force Israel to allow unfettered access for humanitarian aid. I think that's it. Arms embargo and economic sanctions.
I mean, in another universe, there would be an actual military intervention, a Chapter 7 intervention. Under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, UN Security Council, they tell Israel, suspend military operations within 24 hours and then set up an international intervention force and just actually land in Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, the Security Council is proving to be useless, but that was predictable even before the war broke out. The General Assembly is passing resolutions, but there's to very little effect. The Human Rights Council has done absolutely nothing. They haven't even passed a symbolic resolution on the matter. Some countries are cutting off diplomatic ties with Israel, but I think one could argue that there are a lot of ways you can impose sanctions through the international system and not have to necessarily wait for the Security Council. There's a lot of different ways one can decide. Countries are choosing not to do so at this point. It's a political choice.
And then there's the International Criminal Court. I mean, here we're talking about genocide is plausible, the International Court of Justice says, and everybody's talking about forced starvation. And one wonders what on earth Karim Khan is doing.
Yeah, just to clarify, so that was the International Court of Justice that found that genocide was plausible in Gaza. And then the International Criminal Court, which is a court that then holds individuals culpable, has been incredibly slow. The issue of occupied Palestinian territories has been on their agenda before the war even started. And if you compare how quickly the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has moved on Ukraine versus Gaza, you can see a profound difference. They moved very fast on Ukraine, as they should have. And they've dragged their feet on Palestine more broadly and Gaza more specifically. But I will say the work of me and other mandate holders, so my mandate is right to food, there's right to water, there's right to health, there's over 40 special rapporteurs and working groups. Our work has been used and cited in the pleadings to the International Court of Justice and was referenced by the International Court of Justice itself, including most recently in South Africa's most recent urgent request to the International Court of Justice in light of the situation of starvation for provisional measures, which were submitted, I believe, yesterday.
Last point, Michael Thackeray, and thanks so much for talking with me. We're reading that starvation, hunger, imminent famine in Gaza is completely unprecedented in modern history. Never before has this happened in such a tiny territory, in such a brief period of time, in a territory that's controlled by one of the very, very best friends of the Western powers. It's completely unusual, isn't it?
I don't know if it's unusual. In a way, it's playing out a long-standing dynamic that starts in 1948 with the creation of a settler colony. And from the beginning, there was sort of this genocidal drive in the sense of this desire to push out the Palestinian people from their land was from the get-go. So if we think of genocide not as a very particular event, but as a process that unfolds over time and sometimes over decades, it's horrific, but there's a consistency. There's a consistency in sort of this expanding settler colony from an ideology that begins in Europe, right? So some European and North American support of Israel also didn't start that way to the degree we see it now. That changed over time. The unfettered, absolute support of Israel, no matter what, that's more recent. That's more recent. So to go back to the United States, it's almost bizarre for the American administration and President Biden to try and send humanitarian aid in a form that you only use in your enemy's territories, while then giving your ally a degree of freedom that they don't give any other ally, just giving them a blank check, to speak metaphorically, while at the same time, from a humanitarian perspective, engaging the way you engage with your enemy. That contradiction is very new. As of today, I'm still processing what that even means.
And those airdrops, I mean, you do airdrops where there's no way to get in, right? It's the middle of the desert or it's the jungle, it's foreign territory, enemy territory, and it's incredibly remote. Whereas they could go into Gaza massively and deliver aid and reconstruct, it's completely accessible.
Exactly. And, you know, the only thought I have then is I'm wondering, like, what's this all mean? I wonder, and this is not speaking as a UN appointed expert, but I wonder if this humanitarian aid is more a response to domestic pressure. The part that makes me hopeful is seeing how people have mobilized and organized around the world, but especially in the United States, and especially from youth. And I think maybe the Biden administration is realizing or responding to that domestic pressure with elections around the corner. And I wonder if this is more performative as a way of showing they're doing something without actually doing anything.
Michael Thackery, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.
That's our show. Mondo Weiss is a nonprofit publication with no paywalls. If you would like to support our work, please go to mondoweiss.net/donate. Please leave a rating and review to help other listeners find the show. Subscribe to one of our free email newsletters so you can stay up to date on events in Palestine and related politics here in the U.S. and around the world. Finally, if you have any more feedback, send me an email at dave@mondoweiss.net. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with a new episode.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
CKUT's annual funding drive is back and taking place from March 15th to 24th, 2024. We have exciting new merch available for our donors, including t-shirts, tote bags, mugs, magnets, and posters. Thanks to the generosity of this year's sponsors, you'll get a chance to win goodies from your favorite local businesses, festivals, and more, with every donation $35 or above. This year's sponsors include Pop Montreal, Cinema Public, Constellation Records, Mutech, Festival du Nouveau Cinéma, Encore Books and Vinyl, RIDM, CNL Cycle, Adam Hart, Just Seeds, Lola Rosa, Putting Edge, Drawn and Quarterly, Death of Vinyl, La Rama, La Seltzer, Dispensaire Microbrasserie, Luglion, Pizza Bouquet, and Paragraph Bookstore. CKUT would like to thank our sponsors for supporting another year of people-powered community radio. For more details on prizes and to donate, go to ckut.ca/donate.
KUT 90.3 FM. I'm KP, and I am here live in the studio with...
I'm Onyx.
And I'm Kaylee.
We have a very special funding drive episode for everyone today, so please tune in, get your friends to tune in, and we're going to be accepting calls throughout the episode at 514-448-4013.